This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, December 2nd. I'm Carla Blumenkrantz, features editor of NewYorker.com, filling in for Dorothy Wickenden. Last weekend, just as many Americans were returning from Thanksgiving feasts with family and friends, news of a new variant of the coronavirus, called Omicron, began to proliferate worldwide. Little is known about Omicron, but preliminary evidence from South Africa, where it was first detected, suggests that it may be more transmissible than other variants. Omicron also has an unusual number of mutations, about 50, far more than Delta, which has raised concerns about its potential to evade previous immunity. After the World Health Organization classified Omicron as a variant of concern, more quickly than it had for any previous variant, many countries, including the US, instituted bans on travel from Southern Africa and stronger travel restrictions more generally. On Wednesday, it was announced that the first Omicron case in the US had been detected in California. This morning, the Biden administration announced additional testing requirements for international travelers and extended the domestic travel mask mandate. Even as health authorities have taken these steps, they've encouraged Americans to have a measured response to the emergence of the variant. At a press conference at the White House on Wednesday, the president's chief medical advisor, Anthony Fauci, encouraged people to get vaccinated and receive booster shots while the scientific community gathers more data about Omicron.
We have to be prepared that there's going to be a diminution in protection, which is the reason why I keep getting back over and over again and say why it's so important to get boosted. But I think any declaration of what will or will not happen with this variant, it is too early to say. And I think we need to be careful because I know you're going to be reading a lot of tweets and a lot of comments about this. We're really very early in the process.
Dhruv Kular, a contributing writer at The New Yorker and a practicing physician, joins me to discuss what we know and don't know about Omicron, how world leaders should respond to the discovery of new variants, and how we can learn to live with COVID. Hi, Dhruv. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
So you have observed that there are three basic questions we should ask about every COVID variant: whether it is more transmissible, whether it causes more severe disease, and whether it can bypass our immune systems. What at this point do we know about Omicron?
So we have hints, I think, for each of those questions, but we don't have firm answers in any of those domains. And so, you know, when you think about whether this variant is more transmissible, it seems like it probably will be. It shares a number of mutations with the Delta variant, which we know is extremely contagious. A few weeks ago, South Africa was recording a few hundred cases, and since then, that number has gone, you know, to 4,000 or 5,000. And so it's really increased rapidly, and Omicron is thought to have contributed to that spread. And so while we don't have a firm answer on the transmissibility question, it seems almost certain that Omicron will be very contagious. Now, for the other two questions, we're still trying to sort that out. There's not any indication right now, although it's very early, that Omicron will inflict more severe disease when it does infect people. But the combination of it being more transmissible and potentially more immune evasive means that it could still inflict tremendous amount of damage. And then the third question is this question of immune evasiveness. And here, you know, there is, I think, reason for concern. You mentioned that the Omicron variant has more than 50 mutations. Well, some 30 of those are on the spike protein. And the reason that that's important is the spike protein is how the virus enters our cells. But it's also the protein that all vaccines use to kind of prepare our immune systems for a viral invasion from the coronavirus. And so if that protein has changed a lot in this variant, it raises the possibility that our vaccines won't be as effective against the variant. I just want to make one point here. I think people often ask the question, you know, will the vaccines work or not? And it's not really a binary question. The question really should be, you know, how small or how large a decrease in effectiveness will we see with this variant? So will it decrease the ability to prevent severe disease or hospitalization or infection by some percentage that's large or by small? And hopefully our vaccines will hold up well, but we just don't know the answers yet.
Fauci has said that the U.S. will need about 2 weeks, maybe a week and a half at this point, to obtain more definitive information about the variant. Can you explain why that's the case?
Sure. So, you know, the variant itself is incredibly new. It was just detected, about a week ago in South Africa. There's a number of studies, both in the lab and in the real world, that are underway. And so researchers are already kind of taking the blood of vaccinated individuals, putting a version of the Omicron variant into the lab and seeing how well the blood of fully vaccinated people neutralizes this virus. That process takes days, if not weeks, to get an answer. And so that's one reason that we'll have to wait. And the other reason is, you know, the variant has just arisen. And so we need time to see, hey, you know, people who have been infected, how likely are they to end up in the hospital? We know that it takes, you know, often 7 to 10 days from the point of infection for people to experience some of the worst consequences of a coronavirus infection. And so we just don't know at this point whether or not it'll inflict severe disease in people who have already had a coronavirus infection, or people who have been vaccinated, or people who have been boosted.
Meanwhile, many countries have instituted travel restrictions in response to Omicron. At the same time, we're learning that it was already in Europe, even before it was definitively identified in South Africa. And we now know that it's in the US and Canada. So how useful are travel restrictions at this point?
You know, travel restrictions, I think, are a pretty controversial intervention. I think most epidemiologists would say that they have pretty limited value. And there's a few reasons for that. The first is, by the time a variant is detected, it's already usually in countries around the world. So it's not as if the point of detection is the point at which the variant first emerged. And we've seen that the variant is already in at least 20 countries around the world. And so the fact that these variants are already here make the travel bans of limited value in many cases. You know, the argument for the travel bans or travel restrictions are that they may kind of modestly slow the initial spread of a new variant. That's the line that we hear from many leaders in these countries that are instituting the travel bans. And that will buy us time. We can use that time to increase vaccination rates, to roll out boosters, to increase our ability to have rapid testing at home, or to authorize things like the new COVID antiviral pills from Merck and Pfizer, which are currently under review at the FDA. And maybe people will change their behavior. On the other hand, the time that it buys you is actually often very short, if it buys you any time at all. As I mentioned, the variant is almost already always present in a number of countries by the time we detect it. These travel bans are often very porous. We live in an interconnected world. The U.S., for example, doesn't ban citizens returning from Southern Africa, only people with foreign passports. And I think there's another potential disadvantage to travel restrictions, and that's that it can feel like a punishment for the country that has gone through the trouble of finding the variant and reporting it quickly. You know, we should be grateful to South Africa for quickly reporting this variant. But the message sent by the international community is that the vigilance and the transparency that they have demonstrated has resulted in them kind of being shut out in some ways. And that has a lot of important economic repercussions for these countries. So I think any time that there are these types of travel restrictions, they should be paired with some support or some resources for the reporting country to contend with the virus domestically.
And that raises the question of global vaccine inequities. South Africa, where it was first detected, wasn't able to begin its vaccination program until this summer. And today, only about a quarter of its population is fully vaccinated. We know that in low-income countries, the numbers are far, far lower. So what do we know about the role that vaccination rates might be playing in the development of new variants? And what can the U.S. and other wealthy countries do to address these inequities?
You know, vaccination has been and continues to be the most important thing that we can do to stem the damage of the virus, but also to prevent the emergence of these types of variants. And so Omicron has in some ways changed the way that we're thinking about the virus and what comes next. But in some ways, it hasn't changed anything at all. I wrote that, you know, two things were true before Omicron and continue to be true today. The first is that the effect of this variant and any future variant will depend on people's vaccination status, and not just your vaccination status, but the vaccination status of the people around you. And the second is that we need to move as fast as possible to vaccinate as many people around the world as we can. As you mentioned, in many low-income countries where hundreds of millions of people live, less than 6% of the population is vaccinated. Less than 6% has even received one shot of a COVID vaccine. And that creates the type of environment where new variants can emerge. And many of them, as we've seen with Delta and Omicron, are even more concerning than the original strain.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So as we hear all of this from you and as we read the news about Omicron, I imagine that some listeners are reminded of when the Delta variant began spreading earlier this year. It seemed like we might be in a post-pandemic moment during the summer, and then that moment quickly ended. Are there any lessons we can take from what happened in that period of uncertainty and response to Delta as we think about what happens next year?
Yeah, so I think, you know, one important change that seems to be occurring is that leaders aren't waiting to see what the variant does. You know, they've instituted various policies. They are trying to communicate effectively about what might come. You know, with Delta, we were really behind the eight ball as soon as it started to spread. You know, we needed to be acting much more quickly in terms of making sure that we had better masks, making sure that we were pushing out vaccines to as many people as possible to improve the ventilation of buildings, to promote social distancing. We needed to be communicating that and doing those things right away. You know, this time around, I think we are in a better place. I think, you know, people are taking this seriously before it's really inflicted the damage that that it potentially it could. And I think from that perspective, my hope is that we end up in a better place. You know, the other thing that I'll mention is that even if the Omicron variant ends up being more immune evasive, meaning that it can get around our vaccines, vaccine makers like Pfizer and Moderna, they're already working on variant-specific boosters. And that is promising. And so they've told the government that probably within the course of 2 to 3 months, they could have an Omicron-specific booster that may provide additional protection in the event that Omicron is more able to get around the vaccines.
So we know that the Biden administration will announce new coronavirus measures later today. What do you think they can be doing, or that we as the public can be doing, to prepare in these coming weeks for a sort of uncertain situation?
Yeah, I think there's a few things that we can all do. The first is, you know, until we know more about the Omicron variant and how it's going to behave, it probably makes sense to take additional precautions in your personal life. And so if there are events that were large indoor gatherings, or if there were things that you were going to do that were kind of on the border of what you might have felt comfortable, probably makes sense to delay that until at least we know some of the basics about how this variant is going to behave. You know, at the policy level, there's a number of things that I think the Biden administration is considering and may announce soon, including additional vaccination sites. You know, the CDC announced yesterday or a few days ago that it's not just that all adults can or may get boosted. They've said that all adults actually should get a booster shot at this point, and I think that change was informed in part by the emergence of Omicron. There's going to be a real push to roll out rapid testing at home that will help people kind of who have had an exposure or feeling unwell kind of immediately know or have a sense of whether or not they're carrying the virus. And then the other thing that we've talked about a little bit is the availability of these new antiviral pills from Merck and from Pfizer, which are currently under review at the FDA. You know, in the past, specific treatments like remdesivir or monoclonal antibodies, you had to go into a clinic or into a hospital to get those because they were given by IV infusion. These pills could potentially change all that. And you could kind of just go to the pharmacy in the way that you pick up a Z-Pak and pick up some of these pills. And so my hope is that those will be authorized in the coming weeks. And that could change how we're able to combat the Omicron variant.
It sounds like you're talking about a model where we do continue to live with COVID, even as new variants, Omicron and perhaps the next one, emerge. How do you see normal life unfolding as we continue to learn about new variants, including Omicron?
Yeah, you know, I think it's almost certainly the case that COVID is going to be an endemic virus, meaning that it will be with us in the same way that the flu is with us. And, you know, if we're smart, if we're lucky, we can turn it into the flu sometime in the very near future. And that means that, you know, it isn't disrupting our social and economic lives in the way that the pandemic is right now. You know, that requires a number of steps. I think that requires some level of sacrifice in the near term, both in terms of wearing masks, you know, social distancing, making decisions that keep yourself and others around you safe. But I think if we're able to get our levels of vaccination and booster shots to a very high level, there is a future in which in the coming months, certainly within the next year, we're living in more of a normal environment in which we're treating the coronavirus something much more like the flu than it is now. It is still with us. It's still, unfortunately, causing people to come into the hospital. Most of those people are people who have chosen not to get vaccinated. And so that gives me hope that if we're able to, you know, increase immunization rates, that we'll continue to see a decline in the number of people who have to come into the hospital. But, you know, this virus, as I said, is still with us, and it, I think, still will be with us for some time. And the challenge is, how do we mitigate the damage that it's able to cause?
Are there any steps that you're thinking about or that your colleagues at the hospital are thinking about taking, just thinking about the possibility of a new wave coming with Omicron?
Yeah, you know, I think everyone in the hospital is on high alert. We're watching very closely what's happening with the Omicron variant. But really, the steps that that would protect against the Omicron variant are the same that have been able to protect us all along, which is, you know, doing things like wearing appropriate PPE, making sure everyone has masks, creating the distance that we need in the hospital and outside of the hospital, you know, hand washing, all these things. You know, none of those things are going to change with the Omicron variant. They're all going to be protective in the same way. But everyone's certainly on high alert right now, and we're watching very closely what's going to happen.
That's good to know. Thank you so much, Drew, for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Dhruv Kular is a contributing writer at The New Yorker and a practicing physician and assistant professor at Weill Cornell Medical College. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app, and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for NewYorker.com. I'm Carla Blumenkrantz, filling in for Dorothy Wickenden.